Hare Krishna. Welcome back to our second day of discussion on the topic of Make Your Destiny. Today I'll be discussing more about the concept of free will. Last time, in our previous session yesterday, we discussed broadly about karma plus daiva plus kala leads to phala. The idea that our actions alone determine result, or destiny alone determines result. These are two extremes. And the Vedic, the Bhakti worldview is not fatalistic, saying that everything is controlled by destiny. But at the same time, it recognizes that certain things are indeed controlled by destiny. So today our focus will be understanding on, trying to understand how actually we have free will, and how, when I talk about karma, karma is something which is in our hands. So how we have that capacity to choose the right course of action, and how we can maximize that capacity. And in tomorrow's class, we will discuss more about the practical ways in which we can make healthy choices, make wise choices. So firstly, I'll be discussing a few concepts initially. Now, the word karma is often used in four different senses. The word karma is multivalent. Multivalent means it has many different meanings. So one meaning is action. Aapka karma kya hai? Aap kya karma? What are you doing? What is your activity? In that sense, we may use the word karma. Another meaning of karma is reaction. That means, oh, I must have done some bad karma in the past. Or my own karma is coming back to me. Here, when we say my karma is coming back to me, we are talking about the reaction to my karma is coming back to me. So the word karma is also used to refer to reaction. And then after that, a third meaning of karma is also the system of action-reaction. The law of karma is infallible. So, or karma is inescapable. That means that the system, whatever actions we do, they are going to have reactions inevitably, and nobody can alter that. So this is the system, this is the usage of karma as the system of action-reaction. Karma is, this is, and lastly, karma is also one kind of action, wherein there are three broad types of action. There is karma, there is vikarma, and there is akarma. So karma is action that produces good reaction. Vikarma is action that produces bad reaction. And akarma can mean inaction, but in this context, akarma also means action that produces no reaction. So there is a verse in the Bhagavad Gita which plays around with this word karma, and it can be very complex to understand the meaning of that verse. Karman nya karmayah pashyet akarmani cha karmayah sabuddhiman manushyeshu sayuktah krishna karma krit. So Krishna says, karmanya karmaya pashyed, one who sees karma in akarma, and karmanya karmaya pashyed akarmani cha karmayah, one who sees inaction in action, or one who sees karma in akarma and akarma in karma, such a person is wise. Now if you read these kind of verses, we will start thinking, I am not wise. What does this verse mean? To see karma in akarma and akarma in karma. This verse is preceded. This is 4.17 in the Gita. 4.16 is Kim karma kim akarmeti kavayo pyatra mohitaha tatte karma pravakshami yajnatva mokshase ashubhat. This is 4.16. Then another one is 4.17. Krishna says Kim karma karmano yapi bodhavyam. Bodhavyam cha vikarmana akarmanascha bodhavyam gahana akarmano gatihi. And then 4.18 is this one, karmanya karmaya pashyet. So here Krishna is saying, it needs a wise person to know what is karma and what is akarma. Now if you see, actually if we think karma is action and akarma is inaction, if we think of that, then that does not require a wise person. Even a child can say, you know, whether somebody is moving or somebody is not moving. Somebody is acting or somebody is not acting. So when Krishna uses the word karma and akarma, he is talking about it in a philosophical term. Not simply, so who is moving, who is not moving, that a child can also see. But a wise person can only understand what action produces reaction and what action does not produce reaction. So the word akarma can mean inaction. So then the word is in the first contrary. So akarma will become the opposite of the karma in the first sense. So karma in the first sense is action. So akarma as the opposite of the first sense is no action. Whereas akarma can also mean action that produces no reaction. So then that is a karma in the second sense. So the karma in the second sense, when it is used, it is a reaction to our action. A karma is action that produces no reaction. So the important point for us, we don't need to go into the technicalities of all this. This is in the fourth chapter of the Gita. But for us, the important point recognizes that we have the capacity to choose actions. And secondly, we have the capacity to choose actions that will not produce future reactions. Not produce future reactions means not produce any reactions that are karmically binding, that will tie us to an unfavorable destiny in the future. So going further, if we consider that, yeah, I have the capacity to do certain kinds of actions. So where does this capacity come from? There are broadly, the Bhagavad Gita tells, there are three truths of existence. They can be called as Prakriti, Purusha and Purushottama. Or if you want to use it in a poetically alliterative way, they can be referred to by the three Ja. There is the Jagat, there is the Jiva and there is Jagdish. So Jagat is matter. In terms of today's philosophical parlance, Jagat is matter, Jiva is consciousness and Jagdish. Jagat Ish is the Lord of the whole universe. That is the absolute truth. So there are different schools of thought which consider only one of these elements in existence. So for example, right now, say I am speaking. So all these three factors, the Jiva, the Jagat and the Jagdish, all three come together and that's how I am able to speak. So for example, say we know there was a former president of India, once he was giving a speech and he just got a heart attack. And he died while he was giving the speech itself because of the heart attack. So that, what does that mean at that time? If we look at that particular action, so there is the body and the bodily tool. So for example, right now say I am speaking, so how am I able to speak? So there is the bodily tool, there is the throat, there is the voice producing larynx and the whole voice producing mechanism. That is what is important. That is essential. If I get a sore throat, I will not be able to speak. But if say a person gets a sudden heart attack, the voice producing mechanism has not been impeded. Heart attack basically damages the heart. So somebody, if the consciousness is not present in the body itself may be there, but the person will not be able to speak. So in the simple act of speaking, there are multiple factors involved. I might just think I can just sit down. I'm such a clever person. I'm such a fluent speaker. I can speak whenever I want. But actually, there are multiple factors, some of which are in our control, some of which are not in our control. So if you want to speak fluently, it is in our capacity to practice speaking, to learn how to observe how fluent people speak, to learn from them and to practice and therefore become more effective. But that is one aspect of it. Along with that, we can all improve our fluency in speaking to some extent. But we have all a basic voice. And that voice itself cannot be very radically changed. We can speak in slightly different tones, slightly different volumes. We can make certain changes, but our basic voice remains the same. So that is something, again, if you go back to the concept of destiny and free will. Now we all have a certain kind of voice. It may be sweet, it may be a little raspy, it may be a little shrill, whatever it is, that is the kind of voice we all have. But with that voice, what we speak, how we speak, that is within our control. We can change that. So the Jagat doesn't necessarily mean only the universe. It means matter. And we have the body, which is a particular component or a particular unit within the world over which we have some control. So the kind of body that we have, that is something which is determined by destiny. But along with that, so right now if I am speaking, So I have a particular desire to speak. When I have the desire to speak, how the desire to speak transforms into comprehensible sound is a very complex phenomena. Now, there are some softwares which can speak, but speech replication in terms of simple information is basically just processing of information or sound. But in terms of conceptualizing thoughts, expressing thoughts in coherent words, it's all a very complex phenomena. And the way, say, our throat muscles work in order to produce certain sounds, we don't know that. We just desire to speak and we are able to speak. We just speak. Usually, for example, nowadays we have researchers trying to produce artificial substitutes for various organs. Say somebody gets fractured, then the hand can be replaced. Or so like the different limbs can be replaced. So like that, a lot of people have digestive issues. So researchers thought, can we create a whole artificial digestive machine and put it in the body? So now they started it off, and initially they found that actually we will need not a machine, but we need a factory. Not as a chain of complex chain of reactions, and not as a factory that will run several miles long. So now all that, so that if we consider work as force into displacement, then they found that the amount of work that is required when we to digest one morsel of food and transform it into usable energy, that food, that work, say when we take the food inside, there are the different kinds of motion that happen in our body, and by that motion the food moves down and the food gets transformed. Now all this is not something that we do consciously. It's all done below our conscious awareness, and when all this happens, the amount of work that is required to digest one morsel of food is more than the amount of work that an average human being performs throughout the day. We may think, I work so hard and I earn my living. Yes, we do work hard. But what after we eat? We don't know what we are doing. Who is doing it? Now, the only time we remember our digestion is when it doesn't work. Otherwise, we just take it for granted. So God gives and forgives. We get and forget. So the point I'm making here is, when we do our actions, there is some higher intelligence also in the background which is acting. So there is matter and the material arrangement. Say if I'm speaking, then my throat and the mechanism is there. Then there is a consciousness which is there, which also is involved in action. And beyond that, there is the supreme absolute truth. There is the higher intelligence which is also acting. So all these three, this tattva traya, as the Upanishads call it, tattva traya, the three truths, they are all involved in whatever actions we perform. So now there are different schools of thought which emphasize one of these elements. So there is the school of thought called naturalism. Naturalism is not something which you talk about, maybe preserving nature or love of nature. It is not that. Naturalism is the idea, it is the ideology that there is nothing existing in nature beyond the normal laws of nature. Laws of nature means the laws which are discovered by physics. So matter is alone considered to be the supreme reality. And whatever exists apart from matter, that is simply an epiphenomena that has somehow emerged from matter. So modern science largely operates on the premise of naturalism, wherein matter is the only thing that is said to be in existence, and all phenomena are attempted to be explained in terms of matter. Then there is the soul, there is a consciousness, and there are some schools of thought which emphasize the human initiative alone. And humanism the humanity is one thing. To be humanitarian means to be compassionate, to be kind. That is good. But humanism is a particular ideology which enthrones humans as the central purpose of all of existence, as the central pivot of all of existence. That means whatever we want to do, we can do. That comes out to be the idea. But yes, we can do a lot of things, but as we discussed yesterday, you know, there are certain things which are inherently not in our capacity naturally. So for example, if we have human body, we cannot fly like birds in the sky, or we cannot swim in the water like aquatics. So there is the acknowledgement that there is Jagadish. Jagadish is the supreme being. And we recognize that there is a being beyond matter and consciousness, then that engenders devotion. So devotion doesn't mean that Jiva and Jagat don't exist, but they are subordinated and harmonized with Jagdish. Moving forward. So now a few more terms. There is spiritualism and there is spirituality. So spiritualism is the word is used to refer to things dealing with spirits. So sometimes you may see some movies which talk about some ghosts coming up from somewhere, or there may be some planchets which talk about communication with departed beings. So all that, the world of the eerie, all that comes in spiritualism. So spiritualism also, it talks basically about disembodied beings. So we are embodied right now, we have a body, but the soul can exist separate from the body also. So when it exists without a gross body, that is basically called as ghostly existence. And there is a study of that non-material side of reality, non-physical side of reality more specifically, that is called a spiritualism. But spiritualism is not what the Bhagavad Gita talks about. The Bhagavad Gita is primarily talking about spirituality, and it's talking about something more, a more specific form of spirituality, which I'll come to. But spirituality is about the higher spiritual side of existence. There is matter and there is spirit. Like earlier I talked about, there is Jagat and there is Jiva. So Jiva and Jagdish, both of them are spiritual. Jagat is material. So spirituality is that way of thinking and living that focuses on the higher side of reality. That is on the consciousness and the supreme consciousness. So now, with all this background, we will try to understand how we do or don't have free will. So there is destiny and there is determinism. See, the word determinism is sometimes mistaken with determination. But actually determinism is the opposite of determination. That means when people talk about say deterministic reality. Deterministic reality means everything is predetermined. That we actually don't have free will. Determinism is a doctrine which says that there are certain factors which have already determined what is going to happen. So in one sense, determinism is a kind of predestination. And there are, as modern sciences and modern thought systems try to study the human nature and try to understand what shapes human behavior. So there are different factors which were considered. And one of them was, some people talk about genetic determinism. Genetic determinism means our genes have made us the way we are. So if I am short-tempered, why am I short-tempered? Oh, my genes are like that. If I am shy, why am I like that? My genes are like that. So this is genetic determinism. The idea, this is the belief system that the genes determine who we are. There are several problems with this. First of all, that there are something called as monozygotic twins. You know, our genes are determined primarily by our parents. And now there are some twins. Now when twins are born, at that time there are sometimes the one sperm unites with one egg, and then a zygote is formed, and then that zygote splits into two. So, and then the twins are born eventually. Now when this happens, the two twins are genetically entirely identical. Otherwise, when dizygotic twins are there, that means two sperms unite with two eggs, and therefore the two have slightly different genetic structure. But even when the twins have entirely identical genetic structure, even then, the twins are distinct individuals with their own personality, with their own moods, with their own nature. So we are not products of our genes alone. Now our genes do shape our behavior, but they don't determine our behavior. I'll talk about the difference between shaping and determining. Shaping means it pushes us in the particular directions, but it doesn't force us to act only in particular ways. So what is a shaper, when that is misconstrued to be a determiner, then that leads to the destruction of our capacity for free will. So for example, if I'm sitting like this and say this chair tilts, then I may tend to fall on the ground, but then I can hold somewhere and I can pull myself back. So there is a force that is pushing me in one direction, but then I can take shelter of other forces which can lighten me. So like that, each of these factors, they do play a role in our behavior, but they don't determine our behavior. So I am here talking about not just destiny as a concept, some kind of daiva, some unknown factor which makes wrong things happen in our life. I'm talking about broadly in an inclusive sense about what is it that enables us to act and what is it that force pushes us to act in certain particular ways. So there is the idea of genetic determinism, which is not correct. And of course, genes, they basically are known to correlate with certain structural patterns in our body. There is no evidence that genes shape every kind of behavior. First of all, how genes will shape behavior, that itself is a question. But even if we say genes would, but they do not entirely determine our behavior. They may shape. And after that, there is psychic determinism. Psychic determinism means where the kind of psychological impressions that I got in my formative years from my parents, that has determined who I am. So say some children have very harsh, judgmental parents, then when they grow up, then they also become harsh and judgmental. Some children have grown up in abusive families, they may grow up and become abusive. This is the idea that the way we were brought up, that determines our behavior. Now again, the way we are brought up does shape our behavior, but it doesn't determine our behavior. That's why we can see that same person, two people may be born, two children in the same family grow up and they may just have entirely different ways of living and acting in future. So they were brought up by the same set of parents, but they were different. And it's not just that they became different after they grew up. The childhood itself, they may be significantly different. Then there is environmental determinism. Environmental determinism means that we are shaped by our environment. So people make generalized statements, you know. People from this part of the world are like this. People are from that part of the world are like that. People from this state are like this. People from this caste are like that. People from this community are like that. Now these kind of generalizations, the idea is, maybe there is, if some people are like this, then there is an idea that, oh, maybe there is something wrong with these people, and that's why they behave like this. So this is completely wrong. There might be a particular cultural strand in particular groups of people, or in particular kinds of association, which prompts people to behave in particular ways. But it is not a sole determiner. It is not the sole determiner of behavior. So, there is environmental determinism, means we are shaped by our association. That the environment, the social environment that we are in, that shapes us. That does shape us, but it does not determine us. And the key thing to understand this is, we are products of our past, not its prisoners. Prisoners means we become like pre-programmed machines, forced to act in particular ways. But it is not like that. We are products of our past. Yes, I cannot deny that the way, the kind of genes I have, the way my parents brought me up, the kind of association that I had in my childhood, or in my youth, the kind of association I have now, all that shapes me. But that does not determine me. I still have free will. And when we are talking about making our destiny, it centers on our capacity to tap our free will and to maximize our use of our free will. So now, here, we come to an interesting point about science. Science is a very remarkable way of looking at nature and trying to understand nature so that we can shape it to act in particular ways, to understand its secrets, so that we can shape it in particular ways. And those ways manifest as technology. But from science, has grown an ideology called scientism. Scientism is not science. When some of you have heard the word imperialism. Imperialism means, you know, when one person claims to be a king and then tries to control everyone else. That is called imperialism. So science plus imperialism becomes scientific imperialism, or it is called in short as scientism. Scientism is the idea that science alone can explain everything about everything. That science alone can explain everything about everything. So now, if this were true, suppose there were a famous brain scientist, brain researcher, brain scientist, brain surgeon, and you know what, people have complex brain neurological problems, and this brain scientist is able to diagnose them expertly through various kinds of scans. And say this brain scientist comes back home and he finds his wife is upset with him. And then he looks at her, come, let me do a brain scan to find out why you are upset. He will tell him, you go and scan where you lost your brain. So, there is and a side to our behavior which is concerned with our emotions, which is concerned with our feelings, and that cannot be found by brain scans alone. That's why Einstein, he said that we can talk about the ethical foundations of science, but we cannot talk about the scientific foundations of ethics. That means, yes, there are nuclear weapons, there are weapons of mass destruction, they are produced by science, but how they are to be used, that is ethical foundations of science. Or if scientists, they to use their research, for what purpose do they use their research? That is, we talk about ethical foundations of science. But what determines what is right and what is wrong? That is something which cannot be determined by science alone. The Darwinian evolution theory says that we are all just selfish genes geared for survival. Now if we say yes, there is an aspect to us that is geared for survival. But if we look at the most ennobling actions, say a child is drowning in a river and then somebody else just dives into that river and risks one's own life and gets the child out. Or during the WTC, when the WTC crashed, where Twin Towers crashed, at that time the firefighters went right into the Twin Towers and tried to rescue people from there. Now they knew they were risking their lives. And we don't consider this as something wrong. We not only do we not consider it wrong, we don't just consider it right, we consider it to be noble. Here, we see not just survival of the fittest, we see actually sacrifice of the fittest. Sacrifice by the fittest for those who may not be so fit. So that's why we cannot talk about the sense of ethics. That is something which comes from our higher side. It cannot be determined simply by looking at human beings as products of matter functioning according to laws of matter. In fact, the idea that of scientism. So scientism is, as I said, it's not science. It is a non-scientific claim that science can answer all questions. Science itself does not make this claim. Science looks at a particular way of, science looks at reality and tries to find material explanations for material phenomena. But science doesn't claim that it can answer all questions. But when science is extended beyond its valid scope to say that science can answer all questions, then we have the non-scientific ideology called scientism. And scientism is a parasite which takes its credibility from science and makes claims which are extra-scientific, which are non-scientific. So, the President of America is a powerful person. And as the powerful person, the President of America is to be respected. But if somebody says the President of America is the king of the world, say no, the President of America is not the king of the world. So they say, no, you are insulting the President of America. No, that's not an insult to the President of America. That's simply a statement of fact. So science is a powerful way of acquiring knowledge. That's like saying science is the President of America is a powerful person. But to say that science is the only way of acquiring all knowledge, that is not science, that is scientism. And now why are we talking about scientism over here? Because when we talk about right and wrong courses of action, all this falls in ethics. And science itself does not talk about these questions. I'll give one graphic example to illustrate this point again. Now, most of you probably know, that Einstein was a German and he was basically a Jew, and he fled from Europe to come to America because of the Nazi persecution of the Jews. Now he was one of probably the world's greatest scientists of the last century, and yet, he said, if I just base my knowledge on science, then I would be forced to consider that I would be forced to accept that the Nazis, who killed millions of people, they actually did nothing wrong. Why? Because if everybody is simply a programmed machine, then they were programmed to act in particular ways. So they were programmed, if we are simply products of matter, and matter functions according to certain laws, which are like our programming, then all of us, we say we are simply programmed machines, and we don't hold a programmed machine morally responsible for certain actions. Say for example, if I am working on my computer and suddenly there is some short circuit in the computer and suddenly my hand gets electric shock and I lose my hand because of that. Now if I lose my hand because of that, would I file a court case against the computer? I will not. Why? Because the computer is not a morally conscious agent capable of right or wrong choices. I may file a court case against the computer manufacturer. You did not do proper tests. You designed this computer. So the computer is a machine. So just as we don't consider machines morally responsible, then, if we all were simply machines, and the implication of scientism is that we are nothing more than machines ultimately, then there is no question of free will and there is no question of changing our destiny or shaping our destiny. No, we are simply programmed machines meant to be programmed and functioning according to our programs in particular ways. So Einstein himself said that. There is something profoundly wrong with this idea that the Nazis, who killed so many people, they were simply programmed machines and they were not morally responsible for their actions. No, he himself, he was the person who gave the idea for the Manhattan Project, which eventually led to the development of the atom bomb, which was bombed on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And when he eventually saw the extent of the devastation that happened because of that, he was very remorseful. He said that I probably should not have sent that letter to the American president talking about recommending that they do research for developing atom bombs. But my fear was, Einstein said that if the Allies don't develop it, the Nazis may develop it before, and that would be disastrous for the world. But later on, the Nazis were nowhere close to actually developing nuclear weapons, atomic weapons at that time. But the point is, he considered himself responsible. So in our day-to-day conduct, we all consider each other responsible. Now suppose somebody, I speak very harshly to someone, and then somebody, somewhere, my friend, my well-wisher comes to me and they say that, hey, you shouldn't have spoken like that. Then I may say, hey, that person bugs me all the time. That's why I spoke like that. Now here what is happening? Here I may give a reason as an explanation for why I spoke like that. But still, even in such a small interaction, I accept the point that there is a right course of action, there is a proper way of behaving, there is an improper way of behaving. And if I have behaved improperly, I am explaining why I may have behaved improperly. But the point is, we all accept that there is proper and improper course of action. Different people may have different opinions of what is a proper course of action, what is an improper course of action. But the idea that there is a proper and improper course of action, that is something which is always there. And this is not determined only by, again, by survival. There are many factors apart from survival. There is culture, there is upbringing, there is the way of behaving which involves values higher than survival. So our free will is not an illusion. If we talk about materialism, the idea of materialism is actually very popular in today's world. And people think, oh, this religion, all this tradition, they involve so many prohibitive rules. Don't do this, don't do that, don't do that. And there is an atheist gag, atheist joke against Christianity. They say, the Bible begins with, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God. So the atheists make a gag of this and they say, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was no. And the Word was no. That means, they think that actually, when there is a religion, there are so many rules, don't do this, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that. And they think of religion as very negative and restrictive and prohibitive. So people think that all these religions, they are depriving us, they are taking away our freedom. And we want to be free. We want to do what we want to do when we want to do it. So we should be free, that's what people desire. Now, if we see materialism, it seems to reject all restrictions and talk about freedom. Although they talk about freedom in practice, but materialism, it destroys the idea of freedom in principle. How is that? Because materialism implies that we are simply products of matter functioning according to certain programs. So we don't have any free will at all. That is the implication of materialism. So whoever is acting in whatever way, they are simply acting that way because they are programmed like that. So in that sense, if we move away from a spiritual worldview, then we are left with very little capacity to shape our destiny. So now, how spirituality frees us to understand this? A simple way to understand the difference between what is destiny and what is free will is, what happens to us is destiny. How we respond to it is free will. What happens to us is destiny. But how we respond to it, that is free will. And what spirituality does is, it helps us increase the distance. Increase the distance, increase the gap between what happens to us and how we respond. That means it increases our capacity to choose our response. So what does it mean that what happens to us and how we respond? Now, as devotees, we often fast on Ekadashi. So Ekadashi is, we will not take particular food items such as grains. Now if a cat sees a rat on Ekadashi, cat can say, oh, today is Ekadashi, I should fast. The cat can't think like that. Why? Because its behavior is largely a product of its instincts. Okay, as soon as you say food, it is Mahaprasade Govinde. It doesn't say that, it just acts on it and eats the food. So what is happening here is, for the cat sees some food item in front of it and immediately the cat pounces and eats it. So for the cat, there is very little distance between what happens and how one responds. So, for example, the dawn of science, modern science as we know it, the dawn of science is said to be when Newton saw the fruit falling. And then he thought, how does this fruit fall? And he came up with the theory of gravity. Yes, if there had been a monkey instead of Newton, the monkey had seen a fruit falling, simply picked it up, eaten it and gone away. Isn't it? So, what happens to us and how we respond? This is not fixed. This is variable. And increasing the distance between this so that we can make right choices. That is what spirituality enables us to do. So when I talk about what happens to us, it does not necessarily have to refer to what happens externally to us. It can also refer to what happens internally to us. What happens internally means that say somebody has been in a war, and in the war they have heard of gun, they have seen gunfire, they have heard bomb blasts, they have heard cannons being shot, and when they hear the sound of some explosion, now there are soldiers who come back from war and they have a post-traumatic stress disorder. So whenever they hear some sort of shooting, they just have a hyper reaction to that. So now, when this hyper reaction happens, at one level, such a hyper reaction is natural. Because what is happening? Externally, that is say maybe somebody shoots someone, or some sound which seems to be like a sound of a bullet or an explosion that comes, then that within triggers a certain memory. Triggers the memory of the war. And then they may become paralyzed, they may become fearful, they may get into the fight or flight response or whatever. Now, when this happens, if they can consciously think, yeah, but I'm not in the war right now. The danger of the war is not there right now. So if that action may stimulate certain emotion within us. But we don't have to react based on that emotion alone. Now our emotions and our actions can often become programmed. And this programming is subtle, but that programming does not take away our free will. Programming does exist. Programming does exist. But the programming does not, programming pushes us to act in particular ways. We can counteract. We can counteract that and act in different ways. So what does that mean? I'll give a few examples to illustrate this. Now, I'm a writer, so when I use a computer to write, I often, for proofreading purposes, I use a text-to-speech software which reads out what I have written. And when it reads out, then I can check, oh, this spelling is wrong, and I can correct it. So, I had a text-to-speech software, which also had some autocorrect features in it. So, I added, the soul is Sat Chit Ananda. So, I typed the soul is Sat Chit Ananda, and the software read it out, the soul is Saturday Chit Ananda. So, the software changed Sat to Saturday. Now, I had typed it correctly. But the autocorrect made it incorrect. So here what has happened? The programming which was meant to make the wrong right, made the right wrong. So the programming is there, but I have the capacity to recheck it and I can correct it. So that's why they say when you write, you can use autocorrect programs or softwares for spell check. But ultimately the human element is required. The human element cannot be dispensed of entirely. So there are, like that, there are programs within us. And those programs may prompt us to think or act in particular ways. But we don't have to act according to those ways alone. We can choose different ways. There's a Russian psychologist, Alexander Pavlov, and he did some experiments on dogs. And he talked about something called Pavlovian response. So there was a lot of different experiments, but I'll talk about one aspect of those experiments, which again illustrates this principle of programming, after which we will talk about how we have the capacity to respond differently. See, normally, when we get a stimuli connected with food, say, if we see a delicious feast, then there is a natural biological response that our tongue starts watering. So if I see some sweet, if I see some delicious food, my tongue will start watering. Now why is that? because consciously or subconsciously we have associated the stimuli of the coming from that food with good taste and eating. So that's why our tongue starts producing saliva. So our mouth starts watering at that time. So what they did, the experiment is, they got some dogs. And these dogs, whenever they were to be fed, at that time the researchers started ringing bells. So whenever a bell would ring, that would be the time when the dog would get food. And over a period of time, they observed that normally any creature, when it gets sight of food, saliva, it starts secreting saliva. The tongue starts becoming wet. So now here there were two stimuli. There was the stimuli of the food and there was the stimuli of the bell. And both of them were given together. And the dogs would salivate at that time. The tongues would start watering. And after some time, they removed the food and kept only the bell. And when they kept the bell, as soon as the bell would ring, the dog would start salivating. Now actually, there is no need for the saliva at that time. But internally, within their mind, that program had been formed. That, oh, bell ringing means food is going to come. Food is going to come means I should have my saliva ready. So they would start salivating. This is all below the conscious level. So like that, we all have formed certain programs within us. Now, we as human beings have the capacity for self-awareness. Awareness means the capacity to be observing what is around us and to know what is happening around us. So awareness means to be, as you said, to be aware. That is called as the state of Jagruti. Now, it is human beings who have the capacity not just to be aware, but to be self-aware. Self-aware means I can not only look at the world around me, I can look at my own thoughts. So for example, I might just get angry and start shouting at someone. And then somebody tells me, why are you getting so angry? What is there to be so worked up about? And then I try to say, hey, you know, that person spoke like that. Yeah, but why? Yeah, I realize I shouldn't get so worked up. It's not like that. So what happens when somebody asks me a question and I am forced to say, explain my action. And for explaining my action, I have to think about my action. When I start thinking about my action, hey, this is overreaction. So that capacity to look not just at our actions, but to look at our thoughts, look at our emotions and to evaluate them. That is the capacity of self-awareness. So now when I talk about destiny means what happens to us and free will is about how we respond to it. That means we all, our destiny comes not only in terms of how externally events happen to us, our destiny comes also in terms of internally how certain thoughts, certain patterns, certain emotions, certain inclinations may come within us. But we don't have to necessarily act according to those thoughts, emotions, inclinations. We can choose to act differently. And that capacity is increased by spirituality. Prakasham cha pravrittim cha mohameva cha pandava nadveshti sampravrittani nanivrittani kaamshati udasinavadasinam gunairyo navichalyate gunavartanti tyeva yovatishthati nengate. In Bhagavad Gita 14.21 and 22, Krishna talks about how we can become conscious of our consciousness. We can become conscious of our consciousness. That means when different kinds of emotions, prakasham cha pravrittim cha mohameva cha pandava, prakasha, illumination, this clear thinking available, pravritti, this passion, I want to do this, I want to do that, I want to do that. And moha is delusion. So Krishna is using this prakasha, pravritti and moha to refer to the three modes of material nature. The three modes are sattvaguna, rajoguna and tamoguna. And these three modes are subtle forces that shape the interaction between matter and consciousness. So based on which mode influences us, we tend to think in particular ways. we need to respond in particular ways. So, for example, it is said that the difference between the three modes can be summarized as, some people make things happen, some people watch things happen, and some people wonder what happened. So those are in goodness, they make things happen. Those are in passion, they watch, hey, this happened, that happened, that happened, what should I do? They just get worried, this is happening, that is happening. And some people just, what happened? Just wonder, just completely, there's neither proper action nor proper analysis, nothing is there. So this is goodness, passion, ignorance. So there are certain kind of thought patterns that we have. But Krishna says, when these thought patterns come, rather than getting carried away by those thought patterns, observe the thought patterns. Prakasham cha pravrittim cha mohameva cha pandava na dveshti sam pravrittani na nivrittani kamshati. When certain modes of thinking start coming, don't be resentful of them. Don't get carried away by them. Just observe them. Okay, now I am feeling irritable. Now I am feeling this way. The more we start observing our feelings, then we can understand that, okay, this feeling is warranted, this feeling is not all that warranted. And we can avoid overreactions. So, what happens to us is not necessarily in our control. It's frequently not in our control. So, what happens can also be not just in terms of external events, but also in terms of internal thoughts and emotions coming to us. But we do have the capacity to choose whether we act according to those thoughts or emotions, or we evaluate them and then choose appropriately. So everything inside me is not me. Everything inside me is not me. That means that there is I as a conscious being, as a soul, I'm there inside. But along with that, there is a lot of programming around that. And that programming is something which is peripheral to me. Sometimes the habits, the behavioral patterns may be positive, they may be healthy, but sometimes they may not be healthy. So the capacity to evaluate them and change them is what shapes our destiny. And how does spirituality increase the distance between these two? It is by making us aware of our higher side of existence. This is basically a summary of what we've discussed till now. So what determines our behavior? There are these five broad factors. Our past karma, whatever we have done in our past lives, that shapes our swabhava, our innate nature, which we are born with. And that, to some extent, can be called in today's parlance as our genes. So we all have a particular starting point in terms of our psychological and behavioral patterns that we come with. So that is our starting point. And that is significantly different for different people. That is one thing that shapes our behavior. Second is our upbringing. So this is all actually related. We talk about genetic determinism, psychic determinism, and social determinism. The first three are, these three are shapers of our behavior. So our genes, our upbringing, our association, our environment, all these three shape our behavior. But beyond that, we have free will. We have the capacity to choose. And that capacity is not determined, is not completely controlled by these three forces. These three are like prompts. They prompt me to go in particular directions. But I have the capacity to choose. Just like say, if we are using a computer and we are searching something. So if I usually search India, and in the past say I am using Google to search something about India, so as soon as I type IND, the Google autocomplete tries to put it as India. But suppose I have traveled to Indonesia and I want to know something about Indonesia. So then I type IND, it will still complete as India. But then I have to make sure that I don't click India, but rather I keep typing on towards Indonesia. So because in the past I have clicked India repeatedly, so as IND will get auto-completed as India. But I don't have to go along with that auto-complete. I can change it. So like that, so our past choices, so my past Google choices determine what auto-complete options I get. And it is relatively easier to go along with auto-complete options. Even I have to type IND, Then if I choose India, I just have to type one more key. Just press one more key. But if I type Indonesia, I may have to type some more keys. So like that, when we have chosen particular patterns of action, to go along those patterns is relatively easier. But we don't necessarily have to go along to those patterns. We can choose to act differently. And that capacity to act differently, that is our free will. And beyond our free will is God's grace, is Krishna's omnipotent mercy. Now, what is Krishna's mercy? We may think of mercy in various ways, and some of it may be think in terms of explicitly religious ways. Say somebody comes to a temple and somebody say, oh, when I came to a temple, I saw that Gopinath was smiling at me. Yes, we might see Gopinath smiling at us, and that is mercy if we have seen like that. But that is not the only form of mercy that we should be looking for. Yes, we can have some mystical experiences. We may feel very, very blissful. We may feel very good when we come to a temple. We feel peaceful. We look at the darshan and we feel very joyful. All that is very good. But that alone is not God's grace. Ultimately, Krishna's mercy manifests as the inner transformational capacity within us. So Krishna enables us to change ourselves. And so what happens is that there are certain past programs which prompt us to behave in particular ways, and we do have the capacity to choose differently. But when Krishna's mercy comes into the picture, then the influence of the past programs, that significantly ceases, that significantly decreases. And a whole new universe of options open for us. They not only open for us, but they become appealing for us. Dadami buddhi yogam tam yena mam upayantita. Krishna says, dadami buddhi yogam tam. I will give the intelligence by which you can come to me. This intelligence is actually what we need. Sometimes we find that now we are having some problem and we are trying to solve that problem, and the more we think about the problem, the more the problem seems to become bigger. Sometimes we have these boxing matches where two boxers are fighting. And suppose that two boxers are fighting at that time, now imagine one boxer has the capacity to, the more he fights, the bigger he becomes. And the two start off equally, but then as the fight goes on, the boxer seems to become bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. When this boxer becomes bigger and bigger, at that time, the whole fight will become unfair. The whole fight will become such that it will be impossible for this other boxer to win. Because it's just, whole thing has become, this boxer is becoming bigger and bigger. So like that, sometimes when we are dealing with problems, as we keep thinking about the problem, the problem seems to become bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And when the problem seems to become bigger and bigger and bigger, we start feeling, I can't do this, I can't do that. And we start feeling our capacity becoming so small that the problem limits us, but our perception of the problem limits us much more. So when we are facing with a problem, rather than thinking about how big the problem is, now we need to divert our thoughts to something else. And meditation, especially in the end of bhakti meditation, mantra meditation, that takes our thoughts toward the supreme higher reality. That is Krishna. So don't tell God how big your problems are. Tell your problems how big God is. So don't tell your problem. Don't tell God, where are you? What are you doing? This problem, that problem, that problem. You're not doing anything for me. Yes, God will do things for us, but we need to be open to His guidance. And that openness to His guidance is not possible when we are obsessed with the problem itself. So the problem may be in terms of some external circumstance that has come in our life, or the problem may be in terms of some unhealthy behavioral pattern with which we have, whatever the problem it is. Now we don't have to become problem conscious. We need to be Krishna conscious. And the more we become Krishna conscious, the more that awareness will free our capacity to act properly. So, free will transforms into freedom. We'll conclude with this point. Okay, I'll discuss this tomorrow actually. But I'll just briefly mention this. We have free will and then we have freedom. Free will is the capacity to choose. In terms of, in principle, we have the capacity to choose. But freedom is the inner, is the transformation of that inner capacity into constructive choices. And that is what we all need to have. And that develops by the practice of spirituality. So how we develop the practice of spirituality, I'll talk this more in tomorrow's class. But by focusing on Krishna and focusing on the practice of bhakti, we create this distance between what happens and how we respond. Because our actions are not determined only by what is happening. Because if you focus only on what is happening, then we think I have to respond to this. But we understand that there is a higher reality beyond whatever is happening right now in front of me. Then that awareness of that higher reality modulates our response. And thereby we are able to choose wisely. Mat chittah sarva durgani mat prasadat tarishyasi atha chetvam ahankaran nashoshyasi vinanshyasi. In 18.58 in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, mat chittah, if you become conscious of me, sarva durgani, all obstacles, all problems, mat prasadat tarishyasi, by my mercy, you will cross over those problems. So whatever happens to us externally, that may be our destiny. But by Krishna's mercy, we will be able to overcome that. We will be able to respond in the ways that enables us to go through those problems and to grow through those problems. I'll summarize. I started today by talking about how the different meanings of the word karma. We have basically discussed, theme was how we can make our destiny by understanding how we have free will and how we can tap our free will. So I talked about the various meanings of the word karma, that it can refer to action or reaction or the system of action reaction or the one kind of action, that is pious action. And we discussed about how the tattvatraya, that who is this thing, that is, what is the thing that is acting, that is consciousness, that is jiva. And there is the matter around it, that is Jagdish, and beyond them all, there is the supreme, the matter around it is Jagat, and beyond that, there is the supreme consciousness, absolute truth, that is the Jagdish. And we discussed if there is excessive emphasis on one of these factors, then that leads to certain schools of thought which are incomplete, which is naturalism or humanism or whatever. And then we discussed the difference between spirituality and spiritualism, that it's not just some vague concept of some distant beings or whatever. That is not what spirituality is all about. And spirituality is focusing systematically on the non-material side and developing our capacity for responses with awareness of higher spiritual realities. Our realities higher than material. So there are shapers of our behavior, but they are not the determiners of behavior. Determinism is the idea that things are determined by factors which are beyond us. There are different kinds of determinism, that our genes did it, or our upbringing did it, or our environment did it. But no, they can shape us, they don't force us. We can counter push, and we can counter those influences. We are products, but not prisoners of our past. Then we discussed about the idea that we are determined beings, that comes from materialism, which stems from scientism. Scientism is the idea that science has the answers to all questions about everything. So we discussed if a person is upset, we can't go ask a brain scan to find out why they are upset. And scientism is different from science. It is an extra scientific ideology with praise on science, drawing for itself the prestige that comes from science. And we talked about science can have ethical foundations. Ethics does not have a scientific foundation. It transcends science. So if you just stuck only to scientific worldview, scientistic, that is the adjective of scientism, scientistic worldview, then we would have the idea that the Nazis, any kind of criminals or wrongdoers, they are not responsible for their actions because they are simply programmed in particular ways. We have programming, but we have the capacity to change our programming. We have the capacity to be aware of what our programming is, to evaluate the programming and change it. And we discuss examples of programming in terms of, say, the Sat Chitananda behavior, Saturday Chitananda, or the Pavlovian dog's response of mistaking bell sound to be food stimuli, or Google autocomplete. But in these cases also, we as human beings have the capacity to choose. And materialism may seem to be very freeing, you know, you can enjoy whenever you want. But actually, in principle, materialism takes away our capacity to choose our free will. Because we have no consciousness, we have no free will. We are simply products of matter meant to act according to our certain laws of matter. That's what we are, that's what materialism says. But spirituality is actually freeing. How? Because it enables us to recognize the distance between what happens to us, either externally or internally, which may be determined by our destiny, but how we respond to it is determined by our free will. And that free will is maximized by the practice of spirituality, especially the practice of bhakti. And what in this connection we discuss, that there are material elements which determine our action and there are spiritual elements. The material elements are our past life karma, which comes as our swabhava or our genetics. Then our upbringing, which also maybe is a material factor. Our environment, that's also a material factor. But beyond that is our own free will. And beyond that is God's grace. So, Krishna's mercy maximizes our capacity to choose wisely. And thus, we can move forward towards healthier choices. Don't tell when it's like, when we are facing a problem, if you are problem conscious, then our obsession with the problem empowers the problem to grow. And then we put ourselves in an unequal fight, in which we will get crushed. So rather than focusing on the problem, we can focus on Krishna. And by that focus on Krishna, we get spiritually rejuvenated by His mercy. And we can make healthier choices that will enable us to grow. So what this means, how Krishna's mercy empowers us, and how we can make wise choices, that we will discuss in tomorrow's class. Any questions based either on today's class or yesterday's class? And if there are no questions based on today's studies, then any general questions will also do. Yes? Yeah. Do we have a mic? Okay. Yeah, it is there.
Prabhuji, I want to ask about orientation.
Okay.
Things should be. Means whether we are taking the karma of that other person, or I just want to know about it.
So regarding organ donation, if we donate our organ to someone, are we taking that person's karma? How should we behave in such situations? Actually, this is elaborate subject in which there are multiple factors involved. Every faction that we do, we have to recognize that there is always some interaction of karma that happens. And that alone should not be the only factor which determines what we do. Say, for example, if we just focus too much on karma, then we may lose awareness of what is our dharma, what is our duty. If a baby is crying and the mother says, oh, the baby is crying because of her past karma, that's ridiculous. The mother has to think, okay, what is my duty in this situation? So, yeah, my baby is crying, I should comfort the baby. You know, if somebody slips and falls, yeah, they slipped and fell because of their karma. You know, we would become very heartless by such an attitude. So that is definitely not desirable. So we are not, the principle of karma is not meant to make us heartless. There is a natural human tendency to help others. And that is not meant to be suppressed. That is meant to be channelized. Now the problem comes when this tendency to help others is
restricted only to material help. And we don't think of helping people in higher spiritual terms. So for example, Srila Prabhupada would give the example that if a child is lost, if a bill say a billionaire's child is lost, and somebody comes and offers, some person comes and offers the child some food, somebody else comes and offers some clothing, somebody comes and offers some medicine, somebody else comes and offers some toys, all this is good. But if somebody comes and takes that billionaire's child back to the father, that is the best service. So the others are also trying to help according to their capacity, but what they are offering is not the best. So like that, when devotees share Krishna Bhakti with others, what they are doing is, they are connecting the soul who is the beloved part of Krishna, connecting them back with Krishna. So that is a form of help which is not being offered in today's world by many people. And that's why devotees focus primarily on offering that help. Now, while offering help in that way, there are other forms of help which can also be offered. Now, how much one can offer that, how much, that will vary according to time, place, circumstance. So now, suppose we give money to someone. You know, before I was introduced to Krishna consciousness, I was a part of a social welfare organization. And we used to go to village, we used to go to underprivileged areas, and we used to teach various school subjects as a part of an organization that was doing that. So one of my friends, I used to go to nearby slums, and one of my friends used to go to nearby village. And then we found that when they went there, they found that the children, they were not educated properly, they were not able to study and understand the subjects. We used to do that. But often the children in their houses, their parents, especially the father, would be alcoholics. And they would just wreak havoc with the finances, and they would sometimes lose in their, they would be physically abusive. And we realized that actually just offering the children some education, that's only a very small part of the solution for them. So then we also started offering some sort of education for helping these children to, the parents to get off alcohol. And that helped to some extent. But then the elections came up. And then the local politician, local political candidate, he came to that village with 4 trucks of alcohol, free for everyone. And not only the parents, but even the children took it. And then it was just then at that time, and I had my friend, both of us, we started thinking, are we really helping people? So then, what we recognized, that was a time when we felt that we need to empower people, not just in terms of providing education or wealth or food or clothing. These are important. But equally, if not more important, is to empower people to change themselves. To empower people to change themselves so that they can break free from undesirable habits. And that is what spirituality offers us. So our primary focus is when we connect with Krishna, we become free from the lower drives that drag us down. And that, the more people become free like that, the more they can contribute constructively to their own future as well as to the future of others. So there is, when there is no understanding of this higher spiritual help, at that time, any form of material help, that seems to be the only way we can help. That seems to be a very laudable way to help. And anybody who says that that we should not help materially, that can seem very heartless. So now, as far as helping materially is concerned, now suppose the Bhagavad Gita talks about charity. The Bhagavad Gita talks about charity in 3 modes: in goodness, passion, and ignorance. Normally, you would think of charity as very good, but suppose a person is drunk, and a person comes out of a bar and he sees a beggar. And this person takes out a bottle and gives it. Tu bhi kya yaad rakhega? Ye le, pee le. And now that is charity. But what kind of charity is that? Say that person drinks that alcohol and then goes and abuses the family after that. Oh, that is horror. That is destructive charity. So here is a simple example. When we talk about karma, we should not necessarily think in terms of very abstract terms. Sometimes we may give people things with good intentions, but good intentions alone are not always good enough. So we have to also help people to make wiser choices. So charity in the mode of ignorance means people are inclined to act in wrong ways and we help them to act in wrong ways further. So that is undesirable. And that's the spiritual charity where we help people to connect with Krishna and to purify themselves of their lower urges, that is the best. So just as giving alcohol to a person who is likely to be abusive, that can be actually dangerous. So similarly, there is the understanding that if we help people to do certain actions by our charity and those actions are undesirable, then that is bad. So for example, if we help people to if we donate say eyes to people and then those people abuse their eyes for certain things, then that, does that give us some karma? Yes, we empower them to do those things. So then we will get some karmic reaction for that. And that's why every charity has to be done thoughtfully. Now this does not mean that we should not give organs. When we give organs to some people, they may abuse them. And that is a factor which needs to be considered. But that is not the only factor that needs to be considered. Yes, people may also use their eyes for good purposes. And if they use it for good purposes, then yes, if as compared to a person who doesn't have eyes, if they have eyes, that's definitely very good. They can do so much more with that particular organ as compared to without that organ. So now, should devotees give charity? Generally speaking, as devotees, the overall mood is we don't interfere inordinately with the process of nature. The processes of nature, we don't interfere inordinately with those processes. Now, what does inordinate interference with processes mean? The process of nature, that can vary according to time, place, circumstance. So, for example, say, if we are connected with a person who would be benefited by that organ donation, and we know that person, we have a relationship with that person, and that donation is going to help that person not only do things properly in their better in their lives, which they're not able to do because of the lack of organ, and they're also connected with us, and later on, by their appreciation for what we have done or what someone connected with us has done, if they become more spiritually, more favorable towards spirituality, and their chances of coming closer to spiritual truths increases, then that organ donation is favorable. And then in that situation, it can be done. So for example, if devotees have a hospital, where in that hospital certain organ donations are given, done. So and then people have that whole process of organ donation in a spiritual atmosphere where their chances of not just becoming materially benefited, but also becoming spiritually elevated, they are also there. So in such situations, that organ donation is anukul, is favorable. So rather than a blanket statement about whether organ donation should be done or should not be done, the point is we all have to recognize that any form of material charity has to be thoughtfully done. And if we are empowering people, are we empowering people to do right things or are we empowering people to do undesirable things? We have to consider that. And overall, if it helps people to come closer to higher spiritual truths, then such charity is favorable. And if it is not going to interfere with our own bodily behavior, of our own kind of conduct, whatever it is, then that is not considered, that is favorable. Now some people may have some individual sentiments, you know, say the body, traditionally the body is, in some cultures it is buried, in some religious traditions it is burnt, cremated. And some people may feel that, oh, you know, the body should not be disfigured. Nothing should be changed in the body. There should not be any removal of any parts in the body. That is a feeling that some people have. Then it should not be that understanding that this body was a gift given to me by God. And I use this body. And now this body has come from nature. It will go back to nature. If that is the understanding that certain people have, that should not be considered as wrong. So it's, yes, if they feel, yes, the nature gave me this body, and now nature is, this body goes back to nature in whatever form it is. So it will depend on individual circumstances and individual consciousness. So there are, in spirituality, there are principles and there are preferences. And to make matters of preference as matters of principle, that is fanaticism. So matters of preference means that it is a matter of individual choice. So, you know, His Holiness Radhanath Maharaj was once asked that, suppose we are studying scripture, we are studying, say, Bhagavatam. So if we are studying Bhagavatam, at that time, you know, should we underline the Bhagavatam? Should we mark on the Bhagavatam? So Bhagavatam is Shastra, it is Krishna. And how can we mark Krishna? How can we make any scratch on Krishna? It should be just kept as it is. And other devotee said, no, but you know, if we underline Bhagavatam, we mark something, we highlight something, then it becomes so much easier to find that point later, to read it better, and then we can understand Bhagavatam better, we can serve Bhagavatam better by speaking on it more effectively. So what should we do? So Radhanath Maharaj replied that, yes, when we are treating Bhagavatam as a deity, and we consider Bhagavatam as a deity, and we don't want to underline it, that's fine, that's one attitude. It's perfectly fine. Somebody else may think, yes, Bhagavatam is a deity, and when I'm underlying it, that is like decorating the deity. Which is also fine. So here, what is important is individual consciousness. So the principle is that the Bhagavatam is to be served. The preference may be Bhagavatam is, one preference may be Bhagavatam is served just by keeping it as it is. Other preference may be Bhagavatam served by underlining. So like that, a devotee always wants to help others. And we, according to our capacities, in our situation, we should always help others. But in what, the principle of helping is a principle. But the way in which help may be offered, that is a preference. And whether organs are to be donated or not, and how they are to be donated, or with, in which situations to donate, that is a preference that has to be determined by individual people according to their conscience and according to their circumstances, consulting those who are consulting our well-wishers, our spiritual guides. We can make that decision. Does it answer your question? Thank you. Yeah. Yes, please. So when we act, our actions happen under the three modes, and even when we act, ultimately everything is happening by Krishna's will. So sometimes when we act, that is also a reaction to our past actions. So in all this, where does our free will come in? Yes. The modes, we can consider them as a triplet which multiplies. You know, there are three primary colors. From those three primary colors, we can have a large number of colors. Like that, there are three primary modes from which there are wide varieties of combinations of modes that can come up. So now the modes present us choices. But those choices are not compulsions. When we say we act under the modes, that does not mean that we have to act under a particular mode all the time. Krishna, in the 14th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, when he tells about the three modes, it's like we could consider three modes as, I have come till this point and now I have three courses of action. Now I have to go on one of those three courses. If we are practicing bhakti, we can say there is a fourth course of transcendence. But I have to go according to one of those. But which of those, that is up to me. So that means the modes determine the gamut of our choices. The modes don't determine our specific choice. So for example, sometimes, you know, if there is a multiple choice exam, and sometimes within the multiple choice exam there is a typing mistake, so that the right answer is not there only in the multiple choice. So there, I look at it, which is the capital of India? It is not Delhi only. So what do I do there? So what has happened over here? The gamut of choices, that is determined by the examiner. But then, which choice the student makes, that is not determined by that five. That among the five, there is choice. So the student may just say, if all five are wrong, the student may just add a choice, none of the above. So the point is that the modes don't determine our specific choice. The modes provide us a gamut of choices. And within that gamut of choices, if we have repeatedly acted according to a particular mode, then a particular kind of action, we may be more inclined to choose that. But we are not compelled to choose that. So the capacity to choice or choose always remains with us. The extent of the choice, that may vary. So for example, even if somebody is a compulsive alcoholic, they say, I can't live without alcohol. But you know, even within alcohol, they may decide. Even if somebody says, I can't live without tea. Okay, but even within tea, you can take tea which is, you know, which is heavy, which is heavy tea or which is light tea. Somebody says, I cannot live without sugar, but even I want to take sweets. But even sweets, there are artificial sweeteners, there are natural sweeteners. So in every, even when we talk about compulsion, even within the compulsion, there is choice. And based on how we choose, that compulsion increases or that compulsion decreases. So the modes determine the scope of our choices, but the specific choice is not determined by us, by the modes. Now, as far as the reactions to our past are concerned, yes, the reactions can come internally as the modes. That means the kind of modes that we have and the kind of behavioral pushings that we get, they are also reactions to our past karma. But along with that, we also, the reactions to past karma may also come as particular circumstances. So for example, if I fall sick, then the ambit of my choice may be limited. You know, if I'm so sick and if I have flu and I'm weak, then I cannot go out of my room. But what I do inside my room is still free. It's up to me. I can just sulk and feel sorry for myself. Or I can just shout and become gripey and shout at everyone who comes near me. Or I can try to become more introspective. I can read something. That choice is up to me. So, that's why whatever reactions come to our past karma, again, they determine our external circumstances. They may also determine our internal inclinations. But they don't determine our behavior per se. That is something which we still have the capacity to choose. And where does, yes, everything is ultimately controlled by Krishna. But when we say everything is controlled by Krishna, that means that he sanctions. He does not force everything. Upadrashta Anumantacha. He is the overseer and the permitter. He is not the compeller of everything. Now, this is most graphically seen when Krishna goes as a Shantidut to Duryodhana. And here we see that God fails. If God is omnipotent, then how can he fail in persuading Duryodhana? But this pastime is actually a testimony to God's respect for human free will. So Krishna, rather than forcing Duryodhana to act in a particular way, Krishna appeals to the intelligence of Duryodhana. But Duryodhana doesn't act according to the intelligence. So then Krishna sanctions that. So sanctioning means not necessarily wanting a particular course of action, but allowing a particular course of action. So because we have been given free will, sometimes we may choose to act in ways which are undesirable. And sometimes Krishna may allow that. So our free will is always there with us. But based on the ways in which we have used our free will in the past, the extent of the free will may vary. So if there is a horse who is tied to a pole. Now, some horses who are known to be very violent, they may be tied with very tight ropes and the ropes themselves may be very short. Some horses which are known to be friendly, they may be tied with a long rope. They are allowed to move around. So now, all the ropes that are there, they control the horse. But within the circle, within the radius of that circle, the horses can do various things. Some horses can just strain and strain and strain and strain, and they may just injure their legs or injure their necks by that straining. Others, if there is some grass in that area, some food in that area, the others may eat that food over there. So, to summarize it, whether it is God's will or whether it is past karma, whether it is our modes, they determine the framework within which we have freedom. But they don't take away our freedom. The framework of our freedom may be shaped by factors beyond our control. But our freedom, our capacity to choose, is still there. And when we make wise choices, the scope of our freedom increases. Does that answer your question? Okay. So when Krishna says, when he's forced to act according to one's nature, Swabhava Jena Kaunteya Nibaddha Sveina Karmana, he says in 18.59 and 60 especially, what does it mean? Yes, when we talk about nature, there are different things that are talked about. The word nature, it is also multivalent. So one is our basic inclination. So some people, for example, are introvert. Some people are extrovert. And this is basic nature. Now, like that, there are different features of nature. Some people, if they are in a group, they may actually gel with others in the group. Some other people, they may just want to be to themselves for some time. But this is nature, and this cannot be changed. So in the context of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is telling Arjuna, you are Kshatriya. You have a nature to rule, you have a nature to fight, you have a nature to administer, you are a martial guardian of society. And if you become a pacifist, as are the intellectuals, intellectuals don't take up arms and fight. So you become a Brahmana, that will not work for you. So Krishna is telling Arjuna that if you give up your nature of Kshatriya and try to act artificially like a renunciate Brahmana, that is not going to work. So better act as a Kshatriya, but act as a Kshatriya in a dharmic way. So now, our nature is something which is the natural force within us. So if we have to go against that force, that is quite difficult. And to some extent we might be able to go, but we can't go for long, we can't go much. But if that natural force can be channeled constructively, then that can help us to make positive contributions. We can use our talents, we can act according to our interests, and we can contribute optimally. So this is the understanding of nature, that we have certain psychophysical patterns of behavior or inclinations which we can channel in our constructively in our material and spiritual lives, and that we should channel. Beyond this, there is also, when we talk about internally, Krishna talks about basically three broad kinds of, we could say, forces within us, or kinds of emotions. There are material emotions which are anti-devotional, which are immoral or anti-devotional. Now, if somebody says, yeah, you know, as soon as I see something in a shop, it is natural for me to shoplift. Now, this is not nature in the sense that Bhagavad Gita talks about. This is a part of the lower nature. So if this is within Kshatriya nature itself. See, Kshatriyas have a nature to rule, to administer, to fight. But if a Kshatriya starts fighting for no reason, now then that will become like what we have is Gundagardi. Now people just fighting for small things, for no reason at all. That is undesirable. You see, the Bhagavad Gita is a whole deliberation why we should fight or not. The whole philosophy about it is discussed. So the nature to act in particular ways is there. But within that nature to act also, there is a lower side. So that lower mode of acting is because of the lust, the anger, the greed, the envy, the pride, the illusion within us. So these are our inner enemies in whatever way we want to act. And that needs to be countered. So if by nature we refer to our innate propensities to function in particular ways in this world, then that nature should be channeled. We understand our nature and we channel it in our practice of bhakti. In our conduct in our life. But if somebody talks about the forces that are driven by greed or lust or anger or whatever, then those need to be regulated. Jahi Shatrum Mahabaho Kamarupam Durasan. Krishna talks about the selfish desire, we have to give that up. That is lower nature. So when we talk about nature, it can refer to various things. It can refer to our innate psychophysical nature, which can be channeled. The lower nature in terms of selfish desires, that needs to be curbed. And at the highest level, the nature means our spiritual nature. We as souls are parts of Krishna and we are meant to love and serve Krishna. When we are completely purified, that loving and serving Krishna will be entirely natural to us. So when Krishna talks about, when we talk about something which is natural, we may refer to it in terms of our selfish desires, of our self-centered nature, that has to be given up. But what can be of a psychophysical pattern of behaving, if that is usable in our life, then that should be utilized. So that is what Krishna is talking about. Does it answer your question? You can speak, I'll repeat it. Even if you, the mic doesn't work.
So, Guruji, that means if there are any talents that we are born with that can be used, utilized in Krishna's service, they should necessarily be utilized? Or is it that you don't need to, you can make that choice what you can utilize, what you want to utilize and what you don't want to utilize?
Okay. So, if we have certain talents, then are we obliged to use them, or
will
can
there, will there be disturbance? For instance, if we have like a musical talent or something, and we may not use it, may use it, but yeah, that is a very strong talent, a part of a person's nature. So
if we have talent, should we use it, or will it be favorable, or are we obliged to use it, or is it not necessary to use it? And if you use it, can it become too strong a force in the person's life? Yes, it's possible. Now here, Svakarmana tam abhyarcha siddhim vindati manava. In 18.46 in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, by your work, worship him. So that means, people translate it as work is worship. But that is not what the Bhagavad Gita is saying. It's Svakarmana tam abhyarcha, by your work, worship him. So when we say work is worship, then the donkey will become the greatest worshipper, isn't it? So you shouldn't think that whatever talents I have, whatever abilities I have, they themselves are automatically worship. They are meant to be connected with Krishna. The ways in which they can be connected, that will vary from place to place, circumstance to circumstance. So, and then that connectedness is what we also should strive for. Now, if somebody has musical ability, yes, if they can use it, develop that ability, then they should develop it. So it's we all may have various abilities, and some of us may have several abilities, all of us will not be able to develop. But some ability we have strongly, or we feel strongly inspired to develop that, we shouldn't necessarily worry too much that, oh, because of this ability, I may go away from, I may just get too obsessed in that, and then I may go away from Krishna or whatever. That fear is good, but that fear shouldn't choke us, because we all need expression. We all need to express our individuality in various ways. And whatever we are good at, that is ultimately a gift from Krishna. So what we are is God's gift to us. What we become is our gift to God. What we are is God's gift to us. What we become is our gift to God. But when we talk about what we become, it is not only in terms of one particular talent. Some people may just become, you know, they may be brilliant musicians, but in their whole conduct, you know, they're abusive, they're self-centered, they're dismissive of everyone else. That is not all-round development. So even when we are developing a particular talent, we should not get so consumed in that we neglect developing other aspects. So when we are developing a talent, we also need to remember that I am doing this for Krishna. This is Krishna's gift to me, and I am meant to use this in Krishna's service. And that's why if we associate with spiritually minded people, if we associate with devotees regularly, who remind us that our purpose is not just to become artists, our purpose is not just to become musicians, our purpose is to become devotees of Krishna, and in that art, in that purpose, art or music is maybe a prominent way for us to connect with Krishna. So then that balance can be established by having a proper association. So this is focus and balance. Now these are actually contrasting forces. Focus means I want to focus on one thing, and balance means there are many factors in my life, and I have to achieve a proper coordination between all of them. So any development of talent requires focus. But development of the full character, that requires balance. So that holistic, so where, how much to focus on one thing and how much to also distribute our energies between that, developing that one thing and developing other things also. So when we do sadhana bhakti regularly, then we become connected with Krishna. And then if I'm doing my sadhana bhakti well, after that when I sing or I practice music, that music, because my heart is offered to Krishna, then that music will also be offered to Krishna. But if I'm not doing my sadhana bhakti well, then actually Krishna is not there in my heart, my own ego is there. I want to be so great. Then that music, instead of being an offering to Krishna, it becomes an offering to my own ego. I am so great, I will become so great. And that is something which we have to guard against. But not developing the talent is not necessarily the way to avoiding the ego. So when I think that, oh, if I develop this talent, then I will become proud. So I should not develop this talent. You know, this is a misunderstanding. Firstly, we may think, I am being very humble, you know, I will not develop this talent. But to think that I will become proud is to assume that I am not proud right now. So actually we all have pride within us, but we may not have some reason to express that pride to others. So if we have pride, we need to recognize with that. And the cure for pride is not suppression of talent. The cure for pride is purification of intent. It's not suppression of talent, but purification of intent. So when we purify our intent by practicing bhakti, in whatever talents we have, we will be able to express them properly. And then we'll move onwards towards Krishna. Does that answer your question?
What I was asking is, if the person does not engage the talent, is that a big disturbance to that person? That's what I was asking.
Okay.
So do astrological predictions imply that we don't have free will, especially when, say, astrological predictions as given in Bhrigu Shastra, they very very accurately determine certain things about our life. Yeah. Actually, our past karma does determine certain major landmarks in our life. So, suppose if I am going from here to Melbourne, and I board a flight to Melbourne. Once I board the flight to Melbourne, the trajectory is more or less fixed. And I can see, okay, I am here now, I am now come to Calcutta. Now I am coming to Bangkok. Now I am coming to Singapore. So that trajectory is more or less fixed. And once I have boarded that flight, I can't change the trajectory. At the same time, within that, when the plane is going along that trajectory, I have still choices. So, it may also be determined once I take a particular seat, who is going to sit next to me, that may also be fixed. Who is sitting right, left, to my left, who is going to sit to my right, that may also be fixed. But within that, what I do, I still have free will. You know, I can be in a very argumentative mood and I fight, quarrel with the person next to me, I quarrel with the person next to me. And then, or I may just, you know, become abusive and attack somebody, and then as soon as I come out of the flight, I am under arrest. Or I find that a person sitting next to me is a very influential businessman and I come up with a business deal. And, you know, I have a lot of prospects ahead of me after I come out of the flight. So, once I am in the flight, a large pattern of my life is fixed once I have boarded the flight. But still within that also, I have substantial freedom. So astrology can predict. So basically when we start on a life journey, it's like if you consider the body to be like a plane, we have ascended the plane. And at a very broad contour, the body is a plane journey from birth, through youth, through middle age, through old age, ultimately to death. That is the trajectory that is fixed. So that trajectory to some extent can be told by astrology. So things like, you know, just as if you want to go on a flight, they can tell us where are you going to go, where is the plane going to be at this time, where is the plane going to be at this time, where is the plane going to be at this time, you know, who is going to be sitting next to you here, who is going to be ahead of you, who is going to be behind you.
those things are fixed. But still, what we do is not fixed. Now, within that also, sometimes we may say, oh, I want to change my seat, I want to go from here and I sit somewhere else. Some amount of freedom is there. So astrology does determine certain things in our life. And those who are accurate astrologers, they may be able to tell us about these things. So still, that does not mean everything is determined. So for example, I have to take it again very generic terms. If I am born in India, then a large percent of the people whom I am going to associate with are Indians. That is just fixed by my birth in India. Now I may emigrate to some other country and then my people around me may change. But even there also, you know, I may want to associate with Indians because that's what I am familiar with. And I may form a group, then even then I will have a large number of Indians with me. But still I may be interacting with some other people also. So it's not necessary that the predetermination of certain things or the capacity to predetermine certain things necessarily implies that nothing is in our hands or everything is predetermined. We do have free will. And one challenge in dealing with astrology is to know in advance which factors which are predicted are right or which are wrong. We may not be able to know that based on how precise the astrologer is, how precise the particular kind of astrology is, or then how much of a initiative we take in our own lives, especially if we start practicing bhakti. Then often astrologers tell that that is also an important element which may change the astrological predictions to some extent. So that's why we don't have to over depend on astrology. First of all, in principle, astrology does not mean that we don't have free will. It does mean that certain things in our life are determined and certain things are still malleable and choosable for us. Okay. And the other question about, say, if during marriages, if a couple wants to get married, how much should they rely on astrology for making choices? And sometimes some marriages may work out well, even when the astrological charts, they are not consulted, or they may not match, or they are not match, they don't match, still the marriage may work out well. So how important is it to consult astrological charts? There are broadly three, we could say, there are three broad categories of knowledge. Or firstly, you can say two, there is paravidya and there is aparavidya. Paravidya is spiritual knowledge. That is knowledge of the soul, knowledge of God, and how the soul and God can be connected. That is spiritual. That is what the Bhagavad Gita primarily focuses on. That is what the Bhagavatam focuses on. Then there is aparavidya. Aparavidya is non-transcendental or material knowledge. Now, material knowledge that is useful for living in this world and pursuing a goal beyond this world. Now, that material knowledge may be acquirable in different ways. See, material knowledge, everything is not fixed all the time. So for example, Ayurveda is a particular form of medicine. That's a part of aparavidya. And Ayurveda can help people get treated and cured. But it is not that this, when we start practicing spirituality, everybody has to take only Ayurvedic medicine. And you cannot take any other form of medicine. No. There are different forms of medicine. Whatever we feel inspired to take, whatever has worked for us, whatever we find that the teachers are trustworthy, we may take that form of medicine and basically we move onward functionally. So just as, so with, that means with respect to the paravidya that is essential for us to function in this world. For us, that is essential for us to pursue life's ultimate goal. But as far as the aparavidya is concerned, how much we need to use it, how much we feel inspired to use it, that can vary according to time, place, circumstance. So with respect to the use of astrology, a lot of factors come into the picture that, as I said, astrology does determine, can determine to a significant extent the broad natures of people. So sometimes some people, astrology may tell that they are not really compatible. And when that is the case, those individuals, can they still have a, say, a happy marriage? It's possible if they have a high level of tolerance. Now that, yes, there are differences and those differences will cause conflicts, but our purpose is higher and we keep that in mind. So it's not that the astrology alone determines whether the marriage is going to be successful or not. That is one factor, an important factor, which describes the overall compatibility of people in terms of their astrological charts. But even people who are overall compatible, if they don't spend time with each other, or they harp too much on minor points of contention, then even their relationship may get spoiled. On the other hand, people, even if they are widely variable, they are widely variant in their nature as per astrology, but if they work on commonalities, they may still have proper marriages. So whether one should always go according to astrological charts, it depends primarily on one's own understanding of life, one's own understanding of astrology. If one has not had, one has been brought up in a culture where one has a lot of faith in astrology, and one knows astrologers in whom one has faith, not just faith in astrology, but astrologers in whom one has faith, then one may consult astrologers and then govern one's life choices according to astrologers' guidance. But it is not that if one doesn't have any faith in astrology, if people don't have any faith in astrology, and then they are prohibited from making some relationship just because astrological charts say no, then they may become too alienated from the whole body of higher knowledge just because of that particular mandatory, that particular insistence. And then that may be detrimental for them. So what should not be done is, astrology should not be used as a rationalization for one's own short-sighted choices. There's one devotee, Mataji, she has written a book, How to Mess Your Life with Astrology. And say somebody is in a marriage which is unhappy. Then that person thinks that maybe, you know, we should break up this marriage. So then they go to one astrologer, he says, this is a good marriage, you can work. Then they go to second astrologer. And like that you go to 25 astrologers till you find one astrologer says, this marriage is not going to work. And then use that to break up the marriage. So what we are doing, we are not really relying on astrology. Here what we are doing is, we have our own impulses and we want to act on those impulses. And we use astrology to justify that. So, you know, astrology is not a substitute for responsibility. We are ultimately responsible for our actions, and whatever actions we take, astrology can give us some guidance. Okay, here you may have bigger incompatibilities, so bigger challenges. Here you may have lesser challenges. Here these things work out well. But it's not that astrology indemnifies us from our own responsibility. And based on our understanding of taking up responsibility in relationships, and based on our own faith in astrology, our own understanding of what life is, people can, if they feel it's important, they should. It is good to consult astrologers, but it is not good to impose astrology on people who do not have that faith. Because that can alienate them, and later on, they will use that to blame others. You know, you said like this, you said like that, you said like that. So if somebody has to consult astrology, then overall, they need to have an understanding of astrology properly. Only when they have a proper understanding of, not that they have to study astrology lifelong, but a basic understanding of how astrology works, if they have that understanding, it should not be that astrology is used as a rationalization for either doing what we want to do or not doing what we don't want to do. We have to recognize that we have to take responsibility for our actions. And for guiding our actions, we can take astrology as one guide. But it should not be the sole determiner, and it does not absolve us of our responsibilities. Does it answer your question? Thank you very much. Shri Prabhupada ki, Gaur Bhaktavinda ki, Gaur Premananda. So tomorrow we will have much longer question answer session. I'll speak probably for half an hour or lesser than that. So if you have any questions tomorrow, you can come with that. We will discuss tomorrow.
Tomorrow the session will start.